Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Make turn light on too. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Text 8. Laguni vai samamnata.
Laguni vai samamnata.
Dasha pancha chanadi. How you think don't train the verse? Dasha pancha chanadika.
Dasha pancha chanadika.
Te dwe muhurta prahara. Shad yamak saptavadvinam. Laguni vai samamnata.
Laguni vai samamnata.
Dasha pancha chanadika.
Dasha pancha chanadika.
Te dve muhurtak prahara.
Te dve muhurtak prahara.
Shadyamak saptavadrinam. Laguni. Such lagus, each of 2 minutes.
Such lagus, each of 2 minutes.
Vai.
Vai.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Samamnata.
Samamnata.
Is called.
Is called.
Dasha pancha.
Dasha pancha.
15.
15.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Nadika.
Nadika.
Anadika.
Anadika.
Te.
Te.
Of them.
Of them.
Dwe. Two.
Two.
Muhurta.
Muhurta.
A moment.
A moment.
Prahara.
Prahara.
3 hours.
3 hours.
Shat. Six.
Six.
Yamaha.
Yamaha.
A fourth of a day or night.
A fourth of a day or night.
Sapta.
Sapta.
Seven.
Seven.
Va.
Va.
Or.
Or.
Nvinam.
Of human calculation. Of human calculation.
Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Right. 15 lagus make one nadika, which is also called a danda. 2 dandas make one muhurta, and 6 or 7 dandas make 1/4 of a day or night, according to human calculation. Okay, then I'll read text 9. Dvadasharda palonmanam chaturbhish chatur angulai swarnamashai kritachidram yavat prasta jalaplutam. The measuring pot for one nadika or danda can be prepared with 6 pala weight, 14 ounce, pot of copper, in which a hole is bored with a golden probe, weighing 4 masha and measuring 4 fingers long. When the pot is placed on water, the time before the water overflows in the pot is called one danda. Purport. It is advised herein that the bore in the copper measuring pot must be made with a probe, weighing not more than 4 masha and measuring not longer than 4 fingers. This regulates the diameter of the hole. The pot is submerged in water, and the overflooding time is called a danda. This is another way of measuring the duration of a danda, just as time is measured by sand in a glass. It appears that in the days of Vedic civilization there was no dearth of knowledge in physics, chemistry, or higher mathematics. Measurements were calculated in different ways, as simply as could be done. It depends on what your purpose is, and your science will be developed accordingly. It's not that people were so less intelligent or so less informed in other cultures and in previous times, and that now only human beings have become intelligent in the last 150 years. And they've only finally become really human. Before, life was just very primitive. There was no electricity. How could people live like that? You know, and no supermarkets. I remember when I went to Russia the first time, I was sort of, not shocked, but I was thinking how unfortunate people in this country are. You know, they don't have, you know, signs that, with brand names on them. It just, you know, the store just says Ovoshchi, vegetables. You know, how crude. You know, it doesn't say food, food land or something. You know, yeah, that's not civilized. It just, you know, store says Ovoshchi. You know, how crude. You know, it's ridiculous. Why is this technological life of consuming things in fancy packages with fancy names that are not healthy, not wholesome, not necessary? Why is this civilization? You know, and our science, even our art, is all used just for the promotion of this unnecessary, luxurious consumption of unhealthy things. Things that are sinful, mostly. You know, look at the billboard advertisements. Not here so much, but in the West. It's all for, you know, liquor, meat, and the liquor and the meat and cigarettes, and they're sold by half-dressed women. You know, so that's it, is the life. Basically only sinful life. You know, it's like they, you know, you eat your steak with a few potatoes and peas. So there's a few little things that are not sinful on the side, just for variety. But mainly it's just barbaric sinful life. And the whole edifice of science and art is just to further the pursuit of these animalistic activities. Art also. Art for art's sake. Art now is for the sake of selling, of advertising. You know, where do the good artists go? You know, they go into advertising. You know, like the good cinematographers and people who can put together a good movie or a video. The ones who are really good are working in advertising, making advertisements. Because that's where the real vanguard of the civilization is, in just selling things and stuffing people with unhealthy, unnecessary things. So certainly if you have a contrary culture that is actually oriented on promoting what is good, but will actually make people, give people a chance to approach eternal happiness, then the use of art and science is going to be quite different. And that what we see in what we call Vedic culture, the vestiges of which we still can see in India if we look hard. Used to be you could see them more. Nowadays they're becoming very practically extinct, the vestiges of Vedic culture. 25 years ago you could see much more of it. You could see how there's, you know, the traces of a civilization that was based on promoting the real values of human life. And therefore, although art and science were still used, they were used differently. And therefore, maybe not in such a sophisticated way, such a complicated way. But still, everything was utilized appropriately. Certainly, art is used in the glorification of the Lord. You can use the same knowledge of music, of poetry, to promote mundane sex, or you can use it to promote the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the same artists can be engaged very nicely in glorifying God. Even in the West, this was seen up until 400, 500 years ago. Art was expected to glorify God. It was religious in nature. It was used in the interest of religion. Even science was subordinate to religion. So if you went to the university in Europe back in 13th century, you went to study theology. It was only in the 13th, 14th century that they developed separate departments of philosophy. Everything was under the category of theology, of religion, before that. The only other separate thing they had was, you know, training for lawyers. Because that they couldn't afford. They had to have lawyers. You know, so they had just lawyer schools. But if you wanted to study philosophy, you went to the Department of Theology and studied philosophy as you know, subordinate to philosophy, to religion. Only in the late 13th century in Europe did separate departments of philosophy as a something that could be studied independent of how to understand and glorify God, independent of theology. Philosophy began to be promoted only that much later on. And then later, science developed, separated itself from philosophy a few hundred years after that. Even nowadays, if you get a PhD, it's Doctor of Philosophy. You know, the terminology is still old-fashioned, as if philosophy wasn't separate from, science was not something separate from philosophy. Yeah. So the modern thing is science is where you find the reality. The philosophy is just guesswork, which it is in the West. Because philosophy is not based on Shastra. In India, at least some of the schools of philosophy, the Vedanta school, the Mimamsa school, actually based their philosophy on the study of scripture, of the Vedic scripture. There you can have real philosophy. Otherwise, philosophy is just guesswork. Logic, reasoning can be used to explain the revelation of the Shastra. But if you don't depend, if you don't base your speculation on that, then what's the use of it? So the other schools of philosophy are not taken so seriously by the Vaishnavas because they're just speculative. This Kanada's theory that we mentioned the other day, atomic theory, the related school of Gotama, his study of epistemology and logic. They're just speculative. They don't rely on... They may give lip service to the authority of the Vedas, but they don't actually rely on them. So real science, real philosophy, real theology must be based on the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam is not just our Bible, but it's our textbook for all sciences and arts. Not all the details, but the framework, the perspective is all taken from Bhagavatam. The understanding of what is the use of science in humans in a real progressive human civilization, what are the use of the arts, of music, of poetry, that can be understood from the point of view established by the Srimad Bhagavatam, from the understanding of the values of human life promoted by Srimad Bhagavatam. We want to organize education for the future, Vaishnav education, on different levels, for different classes of people. Varnashram education, preacher training, teacher training, practical training in various departments. But when you, any person who's expert in curriculum development, in designing programs of study, can tell you that first you must understand what you're trying to accomplish. Education is like a machine or a complicated assembly line. But before you build an assembly line, you must have a clear idea of what you're trying to produce. So you're building an assembly line to produce a certain tractor. You have the plan of the tractor. And then you design, you know exactly what kind of tractor you want. It's all been designed. You know what materials it's made out of and how those materials have to be put together. Then you design an assembly line to accomplish the end product. But you must have to have a completely spelled out definition of what your end product is supposed to be. Then you can design your system for producing it. So education is a system for producing trained human beings. What do you want to turn them into? What do you want to come out of the black box at the other end? That must be defined first, and then you can talk about how to organize your educational system, plan your curriculum. So what do we want to develop? Do we want to develop more producers and consumers? Or do we want to produce persons that are going to go back to Godhead and bring others back to Godhead? Let's opt for the second. There are already so many educational systems working to provide for the first kind, to add more consumers and producers to the world. Yeah. Forget that. If you want that, it's already being done. But if you're interested in promoting the training of persons who can bring themselves and others back to Krishna's lotus feet, we should understand exactly what that means, what qualities such a person should have, how there may be different categories of such persons. Some Vaishnava is a devotee of Krishna, whose life, the aim of his life is to go back to Godhead. And in the context of ISKCON, we are expected to participate in preaching activities for our own good and for the good of others. But not everybody is going to do this in the same way. Some devotees are going to be functioning brahminically, some are going to be functioning administratively, some are going to be doing productive work, and some are going to be just helpers. So the varnashram divisions of different kinds of training should be there. We should understand what basic qualities we want to produce Vaishnavas. What are the basic qualities of Vaishnavas that are common to all? And what are the specific qualities that we want to see in particular kinds of Vaishnavas? Vaishnavas functioning in different roles in human society. And then devise the proper training systems for each kind. For Brahminical education, we have to train up devotees to come to a point that they can function in the mode of goodness. To be a Brahmin means to function in the mode of goodness. A person may have some qualities of goodness, but when goodness is in competition with passion and ignorance, when a person has a mixed nature, and the goodness is eclipsed by passion or ignorance, then he can't function as a Brahmin. You know, he may have the name of a Brahmin and address. You know, so somebody down the street, everyone calls him Panditji, but what kind of Pandit is he? You know, he's sitting around smoking his hookah, you know, beating up his wife and children, and you know, can't even be expected to go out and get a job. You know, so what kind of Pandit? He doesn't know a word of any Shastra. So what kind of Pandit is he? And you know, what is it? What are his qualities? What are his behavior? So it's not enough just to have the title Pandit, and everybody calls you Panditji. But what we want to train up is for Brahminical training, is devotees who can function in the mode of goodness. Not just they have some intelligence, or even they've learned many things, but they got to be able to function in a mode of goodness that's not sidetracked by the lower modes. Of course, there'll always be some influence of the lower modes in the material world, but we have to bring them under control so that the mode of goodness can actually function. This is how to train up devotees so they can come to this point. That's not an easy question, but that's what's required to have Brahminical education. Not just to stuff our devotees with information or teach them all Sanskrit or some skills of different kinds, how to do expert puja. That's there, but the first requirement is to equip devotees, or in a sense, modify their behavior and their attitudes in such a way that they can actually function in the mode of goodness. And at that point, I'm staring it over a cliff. I don't know, you know, how to do that. I don't know.
How to instill.
Train up devotees? Yeah, how to instill or how to promote the mode of goodness practically. If we find people who are already in the mode of goodness, fine. Just give them some information and send it to work. But when you start with devotees who are still conditioned by the other modes also, how do you make a modification? You can't just, like they make this peta, they take some kind of gourd and they just beat it. You can't just beat the devotees into the mode of goodness. You can deal with shudras like that. Threaten them, intimidate them, and make them work.
But, you know, if you want to make someone into a Brahmin, you got to treat it. You got to, some special treatment has to be there. You can't just beat them into the right shape.
Moving to a college.
Yeah.
It's, you know, ship up or ship out.
Okay, it's
true. I don't know if that produces real problem. I may find out soon. I'll let you know.
Okay. It may not be as bad as it sounds. Yeah. I mean, discipline has to be there.
People cringe at the thought of moving to a college.
But, yeah, a Brahmin shouldn't be treated like that. They're just, you know, kept under control by intimidation.
Yeah,
it's not proper. And even someone who's, you know, a candidate for becoming a Brahmin shouldn't be treated like a Shudra either.
Should be encouraged. Use their intelligence.
Encouraged and, you know, given the benefit of doubt that he's got some intelligence. You know, when you deal with someone who's Brahminically inclined, you tell them to do something, you got to tell them why to do it. You know, not just, you know, I said so and therefore do it or else. You got to give a reason too. Okay, so that's as far as I can go for that topic. Any questions or comments? That's derived from the physics of how to make a water clock.
I had a question. Yeah. I was speaking for some time about this with Prabhupada last week or so ago, and it was about the sciences and sort of understanding. Well, I was trying to understand how much of knowledge of that is necessary for us to sort of dismantle it without kind of getting involved with it, in the same way that Vaishnavas of the past would deal with the Mayavadi philosophers, who at that time seemed to be very much, you know, the rival, and yes. It seems now the present rival is the scientists.
Yeah. Well, one guideline is, you know, I know from the past history of the development of not just Vaishnav, but in general Vedic philosophies and the dialogue, you know, with opponents and other schools, is that interest and the understanding of the necessity to understand, you know, the technicalities of certain fields comes when your beliefs are attacked by your opponent, then you have to defend them. And you have to develop the competence to be able to defend. Just like the school of logic of Gotama became forgotten sometime after the beginning of Kali Yuga. The sutras were there, and they probably date from before the beginning of Kali Yuga, as far as I'm concerned, though the scholars say other things. But the, you know, Gotama Rishi must have been living before Kali Yuga. He must have written the sutras more than 5,000 years ago. But the commentaries were all forgotten. What the sutras meant was largely forgotten. And so the whole tradition of logical analysis and epistemological analysis was lost. Why it was revived beginning around the middle of the first century AD, 150 AD. The Vatsyayana wrote commentary on Gotama Sutras, not a perfectly clear commentary. He couldn't figure out some of the sutras either, and his logical arguments aren't so tight. But anyway, it was an attempt. And then Udyotakar wrote another commentary 100 years later, and then other people started writing. And then the school started blossoming when they had some textbooks and some explanations of the sutras. Why did that happen all of a sudden? You know, about 2,000 years ago. Because the Buddhists started studying logic and using it. In early Buddhism, there was no interest in logical arguments. Now, the early Buddhists would say such a thing like, I'm not going to say that there's no soul. I'm not going to say that there is a soul. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to say that there isn't a soul.
It sounds like Allen Ginsberg used to talk about.
Yeah.
That was his.
But that's like, you know, just refusing to even use logic. Just, you know, insisting on being illogical, intentionally. And the Buddhists for the first 1,000 years or so, the first 1,000 years of the rise of Buddhism, they didn't have any study of logic. Then they started. About 50 AD, you know, some logicians became prominent among the Buddhists, and they wrote textbooks, and it became, and they used their knowledge of logic to attack the Brahmins, the proponents of Vedic culture. So therefore the Brahmins felt the need, they're learning logic and they're beating us to the pulp with it, we better learn logic too. So there was a revival of Gautama school of logic in a specific response to the attacks of the Buddhists. The opponents were attacking using techniques and knowledge, technical knowledge, and so to defend the Vedic system, Brahminical culture, the Brahmins, some of them started studying logic, and they started writing those commentaries were written, and the whole school of Gautama's Nyaya became revived. And the Vaishnavas also, they when the Mayavadis come with sophisticated arguments, using logical techniques and techniques of scriptural interpretation that were taught by Jaimini, then the Vaishnavas have to learn these sophisticated techniques also to respond. When your opponents are using sophisticated attacks at your beliefs, then you have to become expert to defend. That's the criterion. If on the basis of science, our Vaishnav doctrine is being discredited, then we have to know enough of the opponents, what the opponents know, to defend. More than that, we don't need. If nobody has any problem with just chanting Hare Krishna, what do we need to study physics for? Let everybody chant Hare Krishna, forget physics. But if the physicists have some objection, then not every bhakta. But, that's why Prabhupada founded the BI, so there'd be specialist devotees with proper training, with PhD training and so on, who could just, dialogue with and answer the scientists. So it's, to whatever degree we need that knowledge to defend our philosophy, then we should have it. And it should especially be cultivated by specialists, by devotee specialists, who become expert in it, not just dabble. Just like we're studying Sanskrit to put the pundits in their place. We know the Bhagavatam, we're the pundits, you Vaishnavas don't know anything. So we're going to go back to them and say, we know just as much as you do. We can dialogue with you and answer you in your own terms. So therefore we want to get trained up in the language and in the techniques of logic and so on, to be able to deal with the pundits and put them in their place. But only for that, to that extent. Otherwise, we don't need to go further than is necessary to defend Krishna consciousness.
How about being...
We should do expertly. What's the use if we waste our time studying it haphazardly and still the pundits won't take us seriously? And nobody will take us who knows anything will take us seriously. If we're going to do it, we should do it expertly.
The one who wrote a book about... trying to defeat evolution, and he was embarrassed because it wasn't sufficiently researched. And,
yes.
One lady, scientist, really gave him a thrashing publicly, in debate.
Yes.
So that was unfortunate. It was like a setback rather than a step forward. Now the new book, hopefully, has more teeth to it. You got to do it.
If you're going to play with these people, these people play rough. You have to.
People are strongly empowered by the looser energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. Yeah.
Basically, I have two questions. The questions that have come up often, actually, but still, it's in process. We were discussing this kind of thing a little bit yesterday in Chandrahan Prabhu's class. Here you're mentioning, it's kind of like charming sometimes when you hear these very, very natural ways that they measure, in this case a probe, it has to be made out of gold and it should weigh so much.
Yes.
So it sounds scientific, but just as Prabhupada ended the purport, we're advised that as simple as possible.
Yes.
Not overly sophisticated. Then when it reaches, you measure how much time it takes for this vessel, which is so big, to start overflowing. And then, just like we have the story of the Brahmin, he knew he was forgiven for getting a higher salary because, or donation, or a dakshina, however you put it, in Vedic terms, because he knew how to weigh an elephant. He did it very efficiently and very by, you know, the boat and the water, and, you know, it's kind of common sense, but a little take some intelligence to figure, rather than take and try to can't find a scale that big and put the elephant down. You don't have to do that. You can just use a boat. The scale's already there. The question comes up that we accept that as you were saying, your science and your art are going to be tooled according to what the final goal is of society. What is the social goal? What kind of people are you trying to inspire to develop in such a society? So it's understood that in Vedic culture, they didn't get into it, as Yantravidhi, for instance, as much as in the West, not nearly as much, even though they had Brahmastra. But in general, everything that we hear about, even Krishna, you know, went on chariots, although there were mystic powers, which is another very sophisticated technology, but still, in general, there wasn't so much interest. There was Shankya, okay. There was also Shankya notwithstanding, also the infallibility of the Vedas, called Purushottama, is it? Aparushaya. Yeah, the Vedas as Aparushaya. All these things are there, and these are not little things. But at the same time, one can't help but question. Just like in the West, we had the cubit, and everyone's arm is like a different length. So the you know, it's just these are kind of rough measurements. In the West, it may be they just didn't have it developed yet, and they wanted to have it more developed. In the East or in India, it's that they didn't see a need for it. So why, just like Jambavan Prabhu is saying, why should we be like the ass carrying unnecessarily such big weights? Let's just be like the honeybee taking nectar, little nectar from each flower, like that. So the question comes up, if we accept the fact that they weren't so interested in this kind of an analysis, and they wanted to keep things as simple and as little laborious as possible in their measuring systems, then isn't there an incompatibility between that and hard science, real science in this world? I mean, you have to have very sophisticated, precise means of measuring, and you have to have very rigid controls to be able to perform an experiment. There's nothing unsophisticated about it. It almost seems like almost an oxymoron to say, you know, simple science. If you're serious about measuring things properly,
what you want to accomplish.
So that's one question.
Depends what you want to accomplish. Do you have to measure time to a millionth of a second? You know, what for? You know, if all you're trying to do is make a proper astrological calculation, then within a minute is close enough. You don't need, you know, we don't care about a millionth of a second. A human being can't perceive a millionth of a second anyway. So you don't need it, you know, an exact, you know, scientific, you know, what you call scientific, you know, something rougher is adequate for the task. And I think you know, it's explained in the commentaries on this verse, the mechanics of the dynamics, hydrodynamics, of this water clock, that it actually does work. It is accurate enough. I think because even though the measurement may be relative, you know, what Apollo may vary, maybe it doesn't vary, but even if it varies, what matters is the relative dimension of the whole. That's probably mentioned. So, you know, if the Apollo is a little bigger or smaller, I think it comes out the same as far as how much time the water fills up the pot.
Well, I understand that that if we don't need such precision if we're not interested in producing, you know, cell phones and sophisticated computers, that those are... you know, in traditional Vedic culture, are just unnecessary. There are anarthas, actually.
Yeah, we're not going to get too much into mechanics, right. Into sophisticated mechanics, and we don't need such exact engineering.
Right. But then, So, in other words, what I'm getting to is can that produce error in descriptions of planets and universe? Although, again, apurashaya, so that's coming from infallible sources. But at the same time, in Vedic culture, were there telescopes? Sariputta and Vedic cosmology shows them discovering some archaeological ruins, which were some type of planet, some sort of, I forget the technical word for it, but a...
observatory?
No, but these observatories, I think they're pretty much the same design as what we have historically.
Just like in Delhi and in Jaipur, they're still there, these observatories, and some of the tools, the instruments that were used. And it was mostly for visual observations with the naked eye. I don't think they used telescopes. But they were able to do very accurate calculations anyway. Of planetary motions, they could predict eclipses within a minute or so. You know, so they could they can make
some other instruments.
Even with visible visual observations, you can make pretty fairly accurate calculations without the use of a telescope, without the use of computers.
But ultimately, the knowledge of the universe would come from Avaroha Panta, from descending knowledge. They still, even though they had instruments and they were staring in the heavens, and these were people in Vedic culture, but ultimately they have recourse to
hearing
from, for instance, the fifth canto of Bhagavatam,
or the old shastras on the science of astronomy. They were
written by sages who probably didn't use any instruments. They had mystic insight, and by their meditation they realize a lot of things that they wrote down in their shastras. In all these sciences, medical science and all practical sciences, the original textbooks were written by rishis who mostly got their knowledge by meditation.
It's just that it almost seems like, why have any kind of hourglass or just for minimum material functioning, you're saying, just so society can go on, just to have the basic minimum.
It can go on better. You can go on better without this. This technology drags down the values of
It makes life crude and unnatural to depend on mechanics and technology. Example, medicine. So, the original Ayurveda was taught by rishis who were able to explain how to use many different herbs for treatment of human diseases. And it's very sophisticated. Not just a crude herbology, but you'd have to understand a very sophisticated theory of the balance of elements in the body, and what combination of herbs are used in what way, prepared in what way, the medicine prepared in very complicated, sophisticated ways, and then administered in very sophisticated ways, with sophisticated understanding of the what's going on in the body. But all that knowledge wasn't discovered experimentally. It came from the inspiration of rishis who just came upon all this knowledge in their meditations originally. Ayurveda.
It's a Veda. So.
Yeah, that means it came from above. Yeah. First of all, there's the incarnation, Dhanvantara, who taught the basics, and then other sages meditated and filled in more information, but not by experiment. Nowadays, the Indian government has taken over the industry of Ayurveda, and they're promoting scientific investigations to explain why. Like Brahma created the herbs, and he put the various properties, medicinal properties, in all the different herbs. It was the engineer is Brahma. But now, what they do in the medical corporation, in the Western medicine system, they'll take the same herbs and extract, and then synthesize the essential element of it, the essential active substance of it. Actually, the organic herb is a complex. It's not just your such and such acid, that you've synthesized, in imitation of the original. But it's that plus many other chemical substances that work together with it, to make a functioning herb. That was designed by Brahma. But you, modern scientists, medical scientists, you extract one chemical out of it and package that as the drug. And then it's unnatural. It's unnatural and unhealthy.
Yeah, then you can't control the side effects and you cause more disease than you cure. And the modern science of medicine is violent and exploitative. Trying to exploit these chemical forces of nature in order to manipulate the bodily functions. And you end up doing great violence to the human organism. Yeah, we suffer so many side effects, and taking treatment is so painful and so degrading, and it degrades the value of our life. We become unhealthy by relying on Western medicine. You can't live an actually natural, healthy life putting such things in your body. And so on and so on.
And it creates resistant strains and
all sorts of things. And we become dependent on chemicals, and the chemicals poison us, and so it just goes on and on and on. Whereas the same principles are there in the original herbs created by Brahma, and the use of the herbs was dictated by the sages who wrote the Ayurveda. There is a natural system for accomplishing the same thing. And it may seem, from one point of view, crude, because the practitioners of Ayurveda can't explain scientifically. They can't give you a controlled experiment explaining why such and such herb works. So let's extract, the one chemical out of it that will identify as doing, producing the effect, and produce it synthetically, use it in an artificial, unhealthy way, and we call that advance of medical science. But actually, it's degrading it, and it degrades the value of human life. It makes everything unnatural.
It's very, very challenging to see the dynamic principles behind the Kali Yuga circumstantial situation, because the typical response would be, well, you guys say Falina Parachiyate, so yeah. We look in the West, and of course there's a lot of obesity and drug abuse and all that, but that's their fault. Basically, we scientists, we've given people a longer duration of life, we have so many different types of therapies, etc. But, and also when we read, you use the word crude.
Yeah.
That's such a buzzword that would come into someone's mind, like if they weren't totally sympathetic to the Vedic version and they were reading like this section where you measure things in such a crude way, it seems like and the Hare Krishna people, they dissatisfied with that. They think that that's there's something advanced about that. It's crude and primitive. I mean, this is like the kind of thing, the way that...
So who's talking about whom there? Who's calling whom?
A person who's not hasn't made an inner decision to follow the Vedic scriptures, or hasn't been inspired by a pure devotee.
Yes, yes.
When he reads a section like this in Bhagavatam, it's just such a reflex. It's just in fact, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't want to impose my own crudity and neophyte mentality, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are at least a couple of other minds in the room when they heard this, type of measurement, kind of think, gee, it seems a little simplistic, you can just measure things like that, and maybe not, maybe everyone here is sufficiently studied.
I think it works if you're going to measure, what a danda is. Danda is about 48 minutes, danda is 48 mm-hmm. minutes, 24 minutes, yeah, danda is half of that, 24 minutes or so. But it doesn't have to be within a tenth of a second, even. The degree of precision required is not that great for practical purposes.
It depends what your goal is. If you're not trying to split subatomic particles
you're trying to decide what time to do your puja, and if you start 15 seconds later, it's not going to be the end of the world.
Yeah. All right. My other question is just the same old thing that always comes up: the mode of goodness, I have to admit, I got a copy of Kundalini's book, the one I like, which is the Nectar of Discrimination,
yes.
Study of the Three Modes of Material Nature. And he makes a point, but also Bhagavatam makes the point, that it's pretty hard to avoid the mode of goodness. So when you talk about training and vanashram and all that, we talk about Vaishnavs could be of any varna. They don't have to be Brahmins.
Yes.
But without coming to the mode of goodness, I was just reading yesterday, one cannot, in Krishna book, Prabhupada ends one chapter by saying, one cannot become a Vaishnava unless he becomes a first class Brahmin. Yes. In many other places it's said that, one will naturally get elevated to the mode of goodness. So on the one hand we're saying that cultivation of brahminical qualities, this is when we're going to produce Brahman in the Varnashram training. But it would seem like just in all order for people to become Vaishnavas, they need to become purified of the lower modes and become elevated to the material mode of goodness and then go beyond that.
But aren't there practical considerations there to help someone come up to the mode of goodness?
You've got to work with him in his current conditioning. If he's really passionate, you got to give him some engagement so he uses that passion rather than, you know, it just explodes. You can't put the person who's influenced by the mode of passion and just sit him down. You just study and read. He can't do it. He'll be crawling the walls. So you have to engage each person suitably. Even without, you know, having expert theoretical knowledge of Varnashram, you know, principles, if you're a practical manager, you know that. You have to engage people according to their abilities and propensities. So some people you have to bring to goodness gradually by putting them to work in whatever mode they're in now and let them be gradually purified over a number of years.
Well, what it really boils down to is, can one go back to home, back to Godhead, and still, because I'm really a Vaishya or I'm really a Shudra, that's my Svadharma or my Svabhava is called.
It's just conditional, momentary, you know, temporary nature. It's not your essential nature that you're a Vaishya or a Shudra. You just happen to be a Vaishya or a Shudra now. You can give that up and move, you know, and turn into something more elevated than that. And how long that takes to do depends. It depends on circumstances and how, you know, if you really want to do it, you can do it relatively fast. Change yourself into something else. It's not, you know, it's changeable, it's dynamic. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No.
Yeah.
Just that. There are devotional qualities which. There are brahminical qualities, and then there's a list of devotional qualities. And this idea of wanting to do good for others, sarva pakaraka, I guess the adjustment may be that there are devotional qualities which perhaps others who may still be somewhat passionate or even somewhat ignorant, but they may have what's called a good heart.
Yes.
And sometimes we see people who are very lowly in many ways, but they're just so good. They're just good, not in the sense that they're in the mode of goodness, but they have such a good heart.
That is an influence of the mode of goodness, then.
So then that's the dense mode
mixed,
of goodness.
It's mixed.
Uh-huh. So, you know, this is almost like the program for, like, you know, non-brahminical training, and I don't mean to sound like elitist because I'm not even qualified to be considered a brahminical candidate, but is it that's more like... is that like the fast track? And then when we talk about like people who are accepted that, you know, you're going to become a nice devotee, but you're basically really in the mode of passion and ignorance, so work like this, do like this, chant Hare Krishna, even if you can't finish 16 rounds, but chant something as much as you can. And is that like, that's kind of giving the person a chance and kind of assuming that in general that they'll take a little... That they'll take longer. I mean, is that the idea that yeah. kind of like?
Maybe he's dealing with people, you know, being able to deal with people who can't even follow the principles. You can't shake 16 rounds and follow the four principles.
They should be considered candidates also. You just deal with them on their level. You got a fast track, you got a standard track, you know, chant 16 rounds at least and, you know, follow the four principles. And you got a slow track also, which we also should cultivate. The idea of organizing Varnashram practically is so that Krishna consciousness won't be just for a few who can follow the program, but it should be adjusted, you know, presented so that everybody can make some progress, every human being.
Is it also a question of more than one thing happening at the same time, where externally, like the example of the Brahmin and the prostitute, so yeah. she's like really Shudra, and he's Brahmin,
yes.
but he's like... watching all the time how many yes. customers are coming. So she goes back to home, back to Godhead, because yes. she's actually a soulful, good person. Who I can't remember what her qualification was, but she was actually humbly lamenting that. She was praying to the Lord that I'm so fallen, I'm in this low position, and, you know, I'm so contaminated, please yes. forgive my sins. Whereas the Brahmin was just meditating, you know, how many customers did she have? So then she ended up getting liberated or going back to home, back to God, long before he did.
That means is it necessary to externally become materially perfect, to become a Brahmin or whatever? Yeah. That's for the spiritual program, that's not required.
So maybe his modes, due to past activity, externally she was low and he was high.
Yes.
But the actual modes that were controlling the two individuals, it seemed like he, to worry so much about what was going on in the neighbor's, you know, prostitute activity, it seems like he was probably, although he was called a Brahmin, but it seemed like he had some influence of lower modes. Where she was acting like a prostitute, but at the same time, there was something else going on there. You know, there was some higher...
That mode of goodness, the Brahmin's mode of goodness is still material. And at best, it's conducive to Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's easier to become Krishna conscious than the mode of goodness. But if you misuse the mode of goodness, misuse your status and your intelligence to criticize Vaishnavas, like that Brahmin was doing, mm-hmm. She was a Vaishnav, mm-hmm. and he was condemning her. So he spoiled his own spiritual life by that. Mm-hmm. So you misuse the mode of goodness, you can go to hell. You become an animal. Yeah, the mode of goodness can turn into the mode of ignorance if you misuse it, especially to commit Vaishnava Parad. And a person in the mode of ignorance, it's much harder in the mode of ignorance to become Krishna conscious, but it can be done. And Krishna accepts such a devotee, you know, just as much, maybe more.
And one thing that might be helpful is that I don't know if any of you have seen this article by Hare Krishna Devi Dasi. She wrote an article about Varnashram, and she had like a whole... She put it in a real simple grid.
Yes.
And there was automatic Varnashram. I don't know what you called it. That's what happens like in the United States of America or Russia under Soviet.
Yes.
You know, that it kicks in anyway, but it's haphazard and yes. It's not properly organized. Then you have traditional Varnashram,
yes.
Which is by birthright. And then you have... Daivi Varnashram.
Yes.
And the Daivi Varnashram, I think, gets nicely adjusted.
What makes Daivi Varnashram different?
Because everything is, it's the Bhagavatam standard, that the perfection of fulfilling of prescribed duties, or the Bhagavad Gita standard, as in 1846, that you, according, one can achieve perfection by engaging his propensity of work for in worship of the Lord.
What that practically means is that system is organized by Vaishnavas who know the Bhagavatam and are living it. When such people organize the social system, then it's Daivi Varnashram. I mean, how do you introduce the Bhagavatam principles into human society? Because the people who organize the society, they're steeped in those principles. So we need Bhagavatam. We need devotees who are, you know, immersed in Srimad Bhagavatam, even for the practical purpose of organizing human society.
Last night I was thinking that we could meet, not myself, I'd just be like a laughing stock, but maybe get a committee of nice devotees. And I was just thinking of who is the mayor of Govardhan town? I was thinking.
Oh, they have panchayat. The people who own that field over there and want $500,000 for that land? That family controls the town council.
What, the field where everyone uses for passing?
Yeah, the temple wanted to buy.
So it's a rich family then?
Yeah, it's, you know, family that controls the town. Panchayat is a council of five. Oh. That's the system in India. Rather than a mayor, you have a council of five for towns and villages. Okay. And they, you know, their family controls that. You know, the annual elections, but they have control over that. And basically, you know, their family is mostly predominating that council.
Some fantasy or some vision.
Get involved in local politics.
Well, it's such a nice town, you know. But at the same time, your adjustments can be made.
Okay, you can run for mayor.
I could run away. Jiva Mukta has the final question.
Yeah, promise a rascal in every part.
Right. Correct me and I'll be a rascal in every part. And
if you give him sweets, he'll get elected.
And Brahmacharis, you get treated very nicely.
Something you mentioned answering his question, which was the Brahmins. We need devotees or Brahmanas who are expert in Bhagavatam. And that sort of made me think of a follow-up to my previous question I asked previously, which was, the question I have now is you mentioned how it seems like the principle of some devotees will have certain specialties that they're sort of, like you mentioned in the context of science, like particular devotees or like the BI, like Prabhupada envisioned, being able to take on those kinds of arguments and stuff. And you mentioned the Sanskrit example where devotees are the expert in taking on the pundits or you know, the Indian pundits.
Yes.
And is there like so my question is it that the unifying principle between all those ISKCON pundits or whatever is that they're all expert in Bhagavatam first and then sort of and then they have an expertise, you know, that they kind of take on.
It should be.
Yeah.
If the specialists are ignorant of our own shastras, then they're not going to have the full spiritual potency.
Sarabhutta knows Bhagavatam. Yeah. He gets very highly technical class, but he knows his Bhagavatam.
And that means he knew that he had a Bhagavatam. He went out of his way to study it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came with his PhD. You know, he had a PhD when he joined.
He took the time out to
really
study.
So that's highly recommended. Otherwise, we have specialists who are materially competent but spiritually sort of weak.
Right.
Then they're going to squander their energies. You know, they're going to go off on wild goose chases and accomplish not much because they won't have the perspective. They won't be able to sort out everything and pick out what's really important to do. You know, how to use their limited energy and time. They're going to waste their time pursuing some materially interested thing and think that, oh, you know, it's going to impress people and it's going to have so much preaching value, but it won't. You know, unless you have the vision of what's essentially important, then you're going to go off on a side track.
In the past, were Vaishnavas, did this sort of happen? Like, were there Vaishnavas who sort of like focused on the Mayavadi philosophers, some focused on karma monks, or you know, something like this. Has this ever happened before in the past, or never?
Yes, it's happening even nowadays, although not very effectively. You know, there are still pundits being trained up, but you know, they learn some, memorize some things, but what can they do with it? Yeah, they go teach in the school and teach up the next generation, but there's not much effective preaching going on. You know, they're getting trained up for nothing, just to train up another generation.
Well, I sort of lost context.
The pundits, the Indian pundits,
are
not communicating with the real world.
Oh, I see.
You know, they're just getting their prestige. You know, learning all the stuff they have to learn, getting their degrees, getting prestige, getting students, getting you know, paid. But they're not. Making any impression on the outside world. You know, they don't know English. You know, they don't deal with real people, and you know, therefore they don't. There's no preaching effect. We need pundits who will actually, you know, have an effect on the world, on the modern world. They're doing such things in such an old-fashioned way sometimes that you know. They can't express themselves in such a way that will answer modern criticisms. So you have to be familiar enough with modern thinking to be able to answer it.
You have to know the shastras in a very deep, dynamic way.
A dynamic way. Not just memorized everything and not understanding what the inner principles.
To changing circumstances. How the Bhagavatam is universal for all times, but how you can actually apply it and change circumstances.
See, we're not just memorizing shastras, but we're learning the Prabhupada and Prabhupada's purports, he's giving us, you know, the essence of it so that we can apply it. And he's giving us many ways of applying it to modern situations in his purports. But you could also spend 15 years just studying Shastra in a very traditional way and not have any clue on how to apply it or how to use it to actually change anybody's life.
Prabhupada also sometimes displays for us the you might say some of the pitfalls of like when he was talking about the women that having the 32-ounce brain. Sariputta asked him one time, and he said, "That's what that Professor Quark, whatever his name was, said. That's what they said, and he was, you know, authority. So, you know, I accept that was like the turn of the century, and they might have like done a little more careful again measurement. So, Subhav didn't take the thing all that seriously. That was a Siddhanta, something like that.
Yeah.
But that's, I guess, that gets back to the kind of thing that." It's kind of hard to be a literalist with everything that's said, because then you may not know that Prabhupada didn't take that statement that seriously. Either didn't exactly rescind it, but he said, well, that's what they said, so I'm just repeating what material.
Right. It's not that Prabhupada quoted that out of Srimad Bhagavatam, and Bhagavatam was
proven wrong. But Prabhupada said it.
His professor so-and-so had a theory that was later modified.
Prabhupada said it, and he said it in public, and he said it in interviews with reporters.
Yes.
And he created quite a stir about it. And, you know, it's not like in our preaching, we just go out there and say, Prabhupada said, and you don't like it, then maybe your next lifetime you'll have a 64-ounce brain, you'll be born in a man's body. So, you know, just tough noogies. I mean, you know, of course the attitude is an add-on. But just you know, that's one example.
Yes.
Maybe other things like that. So that's why it's like devotional services are razor's edge, in the sense that, on the one hand, Prabhupada said, and we accept, but on the other hand, he said that in a tentative way. And as a preaching, you know, almost just to agitate people a little bit.
Intentionally, just to rile them up, to get them interested.
Yeah, get them, you know. There's this one devotee, Chiru, in Boston. You know Chiru?
Yes.
He used to have like an attaché case, and inside he'd have a whole like little speaker system. It was pretty advanced for like 1975. And because you weren't allowed to have speakers in the Boston Commons. He was preaching in Boston Commons, and he would use that to amplify his voice. And he would purposely get the karmis together to start a debate on evolution. And he would have karmis debating with karmis just to attract a big crowd.
Yeah.
And then he would chant Hare Krishna and tell them
something. Yeah.
He's very expert. Upaya, skillful yes. means. But anyway, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. My water clock is running out, so I gotta do my picture.
It's 8:15.
Really? No, it's 8:26. Thank you very much. All glory, Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.